So again, good morning. We're studying from the book of Revelation. We're studying from the book of Romans. Well, they both begin with R, don't they? And this is a revelation to the Gentiles, for sure, but as Paul called to the gospel. But we're studying from Romans. We left off in chapter 2. We'll be starting at verse 17. But a little bit of review. Paul is engaged, he's the writer of this book, and he's engaged in an argument of logic. The Jews' primary argument has always been, since God chose them from among all the nations and gave them the law, and they also had the covenant of circumcision, that sets them apart from all other nations. And while that in and of itself is true, they believed the privilege of promise that they had, they totally misunderstood that and thought the law was given to them as a vehicle of salvation. While the law was given to them and they had it, the law was not intended to save. It was only intended to bring knowledge as to what sin was. And certainly the law exposes sin. Under the law, you have two choices. You do your very best to abide by each and every part of the law, and your motivation is to stay alive. Because what is the punishment in 99.9 of the crimes under the Old Testament law? It's death. So you attempt to stay alive by doing what you're supposed to do. And if you're able to be perfect, well, then you might achieve salvation, but it isn't the law that's going to give it to you, as Paul points that out. So they stood guilty in the law because, as we're going to see as we go forward today, the Jews didn't obey that precious law that they had. So they were condemned right from the start. He pointed out that also the Gentiles are guilty. And you might think, well, they didn't have the law. Well, of course they had the law. They didn't have the covenant law, but they had a natural law. And they could see the presence of God. And early in the Gentile pagan history, they chose, as mankind does, to avoid the knowledge of God and elevate man, the creature, to a level in their minds equal with that of the Creator, totally ignoring God. And if you think about Jewish history, they did the same thing. They had the law, and right from the beginning, they didn't want any part of it. As I pointed out last week, at Mount Sinai, when Moses was up there, what was Aaron and everybody else doing? Making a golden calf, declaring it's the God that brought them out of Egypt, and worshiping it. So they, from the beginning, too, did not accept God. So you have both of them, which represents mankind. The whole of mankind stands unjustified in God's presence. So how was man to be justified? God, realizing this in the beginning, had a plan. Everything from the garden to the first century leads up to, and many prophecies proclaiming, that there's going to come a point in time that God is going to do away with all of this and establish a new kingdom. His messenger, Christ, is going to be the king of that kingdom. Now that the Apostle Paul has established that the Jews are guilty, the Gentiles are guilty, neither one is justified in the presence of God. From verse 17 on, he's going to explain in more detail how the Jews failed to obey the law, and then putting both groups in an unjustified state, what does that mean? What did God have to do? And then he'll go into detail explaining that, and then he'll summarize his argument. His argument has been three parts. The Gentiles have no excuse. The Jews have no excuse. They both had a form of law. He even points out an argument, if by chance a Gentile did by the law, even though he didn't have the law, the stipulations or the requirements of that law, would his actions be counted to him as righteousness? And it would, except that just like the Jew, no one's perfect, so under that legal system, you're still condemned. The law does nothing but condemn. So there's another system that all these arguments are looking up to, towards, and he will eventually explain what that is. Any thoughts or comments before we go into today's study? Okay, let's go to Romans, the second chapter, and look at verse 17 onward. And remember, the argument that he's posing here is, remember the mind of the Jew. They're boastful because they have the law. They're privileged. Now he's going to tell them, that may be true, but you didn't obey it. You refused. You went out of your way not to obey it. Verse 17, indeed you are called a Jew and rest on the law. Make your boast in God. You boast about that. You're his chosen people. And know his will. This is talking about a person who's going out of his way to do the right thing. On the outside. And approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law. And are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind. Isn't that rather boastful? A light to those who are in darkness. An instructor of the foolish. That's anybody who does not understand the law. A teacher of babes, another way of saying the same thing, having a form of knowledge and truth of the law. All right, you have that, but where do you really stand? You, therefore, who teach another, do you not teach yourself? Remind you of the Pharisees. What were the Pharisees guilty of? Going by the traditions of the law, teaching them, making any proselyte or any new, specifically a proselyte, abide by the absolute letter of the law that they weren't abiding by. And so that's what he's talking about here. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man shall not steal, do you steal? Now remember, the things he's stating here, many of them are guilty of. Appalling things. Verse 22. You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You might say, now that's an interesting thing to say. Remember, who's he talking to? His audience is the church at Rome that he's writing to, which is made up of predominantly Gentiles, either Hellenistic or Orthodox Gentiles, a few Romans, but there are a few Judaizing teachers there who are very boastful because the law was given to them first. They feel they're in a privileged position. And Paul, again, is going to show how that privileged position is not the privilege that they thought it was, because they failed to abide by their stipulations of that covenant. But this thing, do you not commit adultery? Remember, he's talking to Christians. Jewish Christians. On the Jewish side of things in the first century, would you be shocked if I told you that while the law stipulates adultery, the commission of, the wages of that sin is death, that 99% of the Jewish community committed adultery? That's a known fact. You can see that in history. So why would the Apostle Paul add this to the list? Because they're guilty of it. Baggage that they had as Jews, we see evidence all through the first century. They bring that into the church with them, whether it be on the negative side or on the positive side. On the positive side of the law, they try to stipulate that there is no way a Gentile Christian can be saved without obeying the law. And Paul is pointing out, well, you have the law, you think you've got a privilege, but do you obey the law in its entirety? How many people in human history obeyed the law in its entirety? None. And that's the point out of this. There's only one. And that's Jesus Christ. And that's why he was able to be our sacrifice. All right, going on then. He finishes the verse by saying, you who abhor idols, Did the Jews abhor idolatry? Yes, they did on the surface. From the time they came out of captivity, as we pointed out in our Wednesday night study, that has not been a problem of theirs. Other problems, but that is not one of them. He says, you who abhor idols, which they do you rob temples? You, what does he mean? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? Well, you go ahead. They did hate idols, but what does he mean? You rob temple? Do you rob temples? There was a group during this time. You have to step out of history to see that, out into history to see this. There was a group, both of Jews and Gentiles, who specifically Gentiles, because they no longer worshipped idols, wanted to desecrate any temple that they came across. And they would carry off, they would rob the temples of some of the precious things, specifically the idols. They would destroy them. But the point is, was that what God required? You know, certainly it was not what God required. So he goes on with his thought here, and then he'll culminate this thought at the end of the next verse. Verse 32. You who make your boast, that's the Jew, in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? Well, if they did any of these things, yes, they were like the Pharisee. They observe the law on the surface, teach the observation of the law, but they don't abide by it themselves. He says, verse 24, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written, and he'll be quoting from Ezekiel, the 16th chapter and the 32nd chapter, and Isaiah, the 52nd chapter. For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law. Remember, their argument was, we were given the law. We're God's chosen people. And oh, by the way, we have a sign that sets us apart from any other race of people on the globe, this covenant of circumcision. So Paul now starts to address that. You see, in verse 24, he said, by these previous actions, while you're boasting under the law, you're being blasphemed against. God is being blasphemed against because you're saying this is important, but you're not abiding by it. You're looking very foolish. And God is taking the brunt of that. In verse 25, he says, for circumcision is indeed profitable if... And the idea is if and only if you keep the law. But if you are a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. What does he mean by circumcision becoming uncircumcision? That's obviously not possible. What's he talking about? He's not talking about a physical circumcision, which is what the Jews held in preeminence. Yes. Absolutely. What he's pointing out is, you boast because you have the law, Mr. Jew. You have this sign that sets you apart. And so in your haughtiness, you think you're better than anybody else, but you're not abiding by that thing you esteem so precious. And so the outcome is, that circumcision you have hasn't done you any good. You're no better off than the Gentile you're taunting, who you think is a barbarian because they don't have the law as you did, and you're in the same category they are. Mr. Jew, do you realize that? You're not justified in the sight of God. They're not justified, for sure, but you're not justified. So what does God have to do in order for you both to be justified? And that's what he's leading up to, which he'll talk about here in the next two chapters. Okay, verse 26. Therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? And the idea is, it's not the works of the law that's doing anything. It's where the heart is. The circumcision he's talking about is not physical. The Jew was physically circumcised. The Gentile was not. They could both be circumcised of the heart if their heart was justified or in the right position with God. Neither one. Both classes know God in their history, and both classes refuse to do what was right in the sight of God, i.e., that puts them both in the same predicament. There's no justification and there's no salvation as that stands. Something else has to be... The argument he's leading up to is, because of all of this, he's trying to show that there is absolutely nothing a human being can do himself, whether it be under the law or whether it be outside the law as the Gentile. Nothing can bring about salvation. There's nothing we can do. We're not good enough. Isaiah pointed out clearly, we're not good enough. We're not that perfect lamb. Christ was. So that's the sacrifice all of this is leading up to. And in doing that, it wipes out or sets aside the old system, all for a better system, where mankind in general, whether you be a Jew, whether you be a Greek, whatever kind of Greek, a Roman, a bar, it doesn't matter who you are, you all can be justified in the sight of God following God's will. And he'll point out what that is as we go on. Okay, verse 27. And will not the physical uncircumcision, if he fulfills the law, judge you, who even with your written code and circumcision are a transgressor of the law? So he's leading up to an argument that he already made in the previous chapter, actually in the previous section in verse 15. If by chance an individual who's a Gentile manages to keep the requirements of the law, how is that counted to him? Now, is that possible? And last week I said, does that cause a name to pop up in your mind? Who was an individual in the early history of the church? Cornelius. Who was a Gentile who kept the law? And it was all of that effort on his part was counted to him as righteous. But he's a good example to show keeping the law. He was keeping the law, great, but did that save him? No. What happened? A special message was sent to him via Peter to teach him the new system, which was going to be the thing that does bring salvation. And so he's a good example. Neither side, by the works of the law, are saved. All the Jew did by trying to keep the law was, in fact, trying to keep himself alive. Because if he was found a lawbreaker, he'd be put to death. That's not salvation. That's not salvation. Okay, going forward. Verse 28. For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is that circumcision which is outwardly in the flesh. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, and not the letter, meaning the letter of the law, whose praise is not from men, but from God. You understand the point that he's making? The point that he's making here, whether you be Jew or whether you be Greek, uncircumcision and standing righteous, or circumcision under the law, that did not justify you. The only circumcision that counts, if you will, is the state of your heart. You can be physically uncircumcised, and if your heart is in the right place and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing towards God, obedience in other words, then that'll be counted to you just as if you were one who had circumcision. Because remember, when salvation finally came, who did it come to first? The Jews. The Jews, though they stood in a situation where they had failed miserably, they had failed to keep the law that they held in esteem, nonetheless, when salvation came, it came to them first, and then afterwards to the Greek. He'll point out, as we go on in the next chapter, that the judgment associated with that, who gets judged first? Who transgressed first? The Jew, and then the Greek. So, to show that God is in no way showing partiality. See, he went through this elaborate argument to show that all mankind are in the same boat. The Jew has no privilege, else God would be showing partiality. They were there to serve a purpose. They failed at the purpose, but did God fail? No. Even though they failed to keep the law, the statutes were still there. People outside understood that they boasted that they had the law, as Cornelius shows, has the ability to see what that law is and abide by it or not abide by it. God didn't fail in that purpose. It's all leading up to when that messenger finally comes. In this case, he's already came. The new kingdom is already established, but you have these people within it who still want to hang on to the baggage from the old system. And so this is all leading up to that declaration. The old is gone, and there's a new and better system. We'll stop right here and see if there's any questions, thoughts, or comments. Yes, Chris.
We know that this is a true person that the
right. Exactly. The Judaizers forget the Jerusalem Council that had already taken place about 16 years after the establishment of the church. This is much later than that. Paul is thought to have been martyred in about 68 AD. And this is at least, this congregation is about 25 years old, and we believe started with the migrants from those that were there at the day of Pentecost, because they're in that list. Acts, the second chapter, that Peter was talking to. So we believe that's how old this church is. So if you do the math, you see that 25 years has gone by. The first 16, they had at the end of that, they had that council. And what was it that James said? Out of that whole thing, the very last statement that he made was circumcision is not to be bound on the Gentiles, and they all agreed with that. And Paul took that message with him on each of his journeys. But you see, now 25 years old, and they're still having that problem. They're going to be having problems of one type or another from now on. The Apostle Paul mentions that in Acts, the 20th chapter, when he meets with the elders of Ephesus, he points out that grievous wolves are going to come in from your own number, from among the elders, and attempt to teach various heresies. And when I finally do teach the class on church history, I'll point out how very slight these changes happen, but things that we feel are very modern issues today started at even before the death of the last apostle. And after the death of the last apostle, you can imagine, they mushroom real quick, because there's not many who can really challenge that. Because the word had not been really written down and collected together as we have it. It was letters that were handed out to various congregations, circulated among them. Mostly it was oral communication. Any other thoughts or comments before we go on? Okay. Now, mind you, keep in mind the psychological state of mind of this congregation, who it was that he's talking to. At the end of the first chapter, his address is focused on the Gentile, and you can just see these Jews very proud saying, oh, ho, ho, he's really knocking them good. And then, in chapter 2, his attention focuses to the Jew, and how does he start that argument? Lest you boast in your position. Guess where you stand in all of this? And he's not through talking to them yet. Can you imagine how they must be receiving this? Because see, one of the things that, as Paul is going to explain, that they taught against him is they considered him, the Jew, considered him a Jewish heretic. And for that reason, really questioned anything Paul had to say. And considered him, and that baggage came with them into the church. He had to defend his position everywhere he went, especially against this group of people. So that is why he is making it very, very clear to the Jew where they stand, or where they don't stand as they thought they did in the sight of God. And it's very important because he'll say, you consider my propositions as a lie. Well, let's look at it as though I'm a liar. And he deals with that logically also. And the conclusion at the end of it is, again, you do not stand justified, Mr. Jew. You know, you need to listen to your own history and your own prophets, and you can figure out what's going on. Any other thoughts or comments? Then we're going to start with chapter 3. We have about a half an hour more. In this section, he's going to point out how it was that the Jews were not keeping the oracles or the commandments, their covenant, that they held in such high esteem. They had it. They boasted that they had it, but they might as well not have had it. Okay, chapter 3, verse 1. What advantage then has the Jew? Or what is the profit of circumcision? See, what was the Jew confused about circumcision? What did they associate it with? They associated it with the law. But was circumcision given to them at the time of Mount Sinai? When was circumcision given to the Jew? With Abraham. It was a covenant standalone long before Mount Sinai. Long before they were given that distinction. That was a separate thing. That just set the Jew aside. He didn't have the law yet. He had the option, as Hebrews 11 points out, faith was the thing. His ability to, in fact, for Abraham, it says, he's the one talked the most about in two different sections, but that last section in chapter 11, the writer of Hebrews, maybe it was Paul, maybe it was Clement of Rome, whatever you believe, makes it clear that what was actually attributed to Abraham, all of these things was attributed to him by faith because he had the ability to, though not receiving the promise, was able to look out far in the future and see it coming. What was that promise? The new kingdom and Jesus Christ specifically. And so that's how these patriarchs were justified by faith. They couldn't reach out and touch Christ. They couldn't see or touch or be part of the new system, but they certainly had faith that in God that it was going to happen. So again, their faith is what justified them. And the law was not what saved them. It was where their heart was. Abraham, a good example of where the heart is with relation to God, to the extent he would have been willing to sacrifice his own son. Hebrews makes it clear his thinking was God had the power to raise him up alive again. That's stated clearly in that chapter. Okay, so back to what we're talking about here. So then what advantage has the Jew, or what profit of circumcision? Much in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God. It's not circumcision that did anything, but you were given a law, a covenant. Verse 3, for what if some did not believe? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? We know that when the law was given at Mount Sinai, as they're wandering through the wilderness, there was many that didn't believe. They were there because the slaves in Egypt, the Jews, were released. And they were, some of them were Egyptians that tagged along. Some of them were Jews. You've heard me say this before. If you took a slice right down through the middle of San Jose, just a little section, and you laid it out to look at it what classes of people would you find? Overall, you would find believers and unbelievers. Just because the Jew was given the law on Mount Sinai didn't really make them any different than anybody else. If you took that same slice out of them, you would have believers and unbelievers. There were some who were going through the motions of the law because they didn't want to look any different. But did they really believe? Periodically, their disbelief shows up, and we find many people being slaughtered by God righteously because of their unbelief. And so you can read that for yourself in Genesis. So Paul's argument is a good one. If they don't believe, does that make God of no effect or his plan of no effect? No. And he'll answer this. No. God's plan is going to progress with or without mankind. Cooperation. God doesn't need our help. So here's his argument. He asks the question, if they don't believe, does their unbelief make God's faithfulness without effect? Verse 4, certainly not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and may overcome when you are judged. But if, and that's out of Psalms, by the way, and a similar thought is in John the 3rd chapter, 33rd verse. Verse 5, but if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unjust who inflicts wrath? And in most Bibles, it's in parentheses. The Apostle Paul injects something here. Now, remember the thought, is God unjust for taking action, showing wrath? Now, he says, I speak as a man. There's been a lot of ways that's interpreted. What do you think he means, the apostle, whenever he says, I speak as a man? Is he speaking for himself? A lot of people believe that. A lot of people believe that he's writing the book as an inspired person, and now he's going to inject a thought from him. If you read the context of this, you realize that's not at all what he's doing. He's talking to a group of people who consider him a liar. Remember that. That's important. So they're very cautious about what he says and about what arguments he makes. And so now he's injecting in this argument what that kind of mindset, a man of that kind of mindset, what they would say. It's not what the Apostle Paul believes, but he wants to continue this argument. It's the argument, is God of no effect, or his plan, his righteousness, because some people have a law and refuse to abide by it. On the other hand, we who don't have the law, the Gentile, and can abide by its principles and have it reconciled to us or counted to us as righteousness, what effect does that have on God's plan? And then, oh, by the way, now that all mankind have the same promise, the same hope through Jesus Christ, does that mean that we then have the right to do wrong so we build up God? See, that's the argument these people would really be making if you take it right down and follow their line of reasoning. And the Apostle Paul, in verse 6, is going to dispel that. But for right now, he's injecting this thought. Keep in mind that he's talking as this group of people he's talking to would be talking. This is their argument against what he's saying. Here's what he says to that in verse 6. Remember, he ended it, is God unjust who inflicts wrath in this case? Verse 6 says, certainly not. For then how will God judge the world? What does God? What's the instrument God uses to judge anybody? Go ahead. His word, absolutely. Under the old system, his word was the law. And Paul has adequately pointed out that the law is not a vehicle for salvation, but is a vehicle to point out what sin is, and if you fall in that category, death is the recompense for that. So, is there some other system? If God is going to judge under the law, he'll judge by the law, his word. Under a new system, there's new words. And the judgment's going to be based on that. One, really, the judgment of whether you keep the law or not, if the law is being applied absolutely to the letter, would be, are you still alive standing? Under the new system, it is, where's the heart? Where's your faith? You're not going through the motions. Are you doing it because you want to be? Remember what was said in Isaiah? Under the new system, there'll come a day when my statutes are written on their heart. Meaning, they come to him because they want to come to him, not because they're born into a community that's quote-unquote God's chosen people, that Paul has adequately chosen, did not merit them for anything. The only merit they could get out of that is, are you alive or are you dead? You know, if the law was applied the way it was meant to be applied. All right. So verse 6, he said, certainly not, for then how will God judge the world? Verse 7, for if the truth of God has increased through my lie to his glory, what's the lie the Apostle Paul is talking about? He's being accused, or in many of the congregation he's visited, as being a liar because he's dispelling circumcision is not necessary under the new system. So he's saying, for if the truth of God has increased through my lie to his glory, why am I also still judged as a sinner? And why not say, he's carrying this argument, remember, he's still talking as the individual talking to him, he's carrying it one step further. And why not say, let us do evil, that good may come? Well, that's an extension of that argument. Here's what Paul has to say. As we, meaning himself, are slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, their condemnation is just. Some were using the argument that since the Apostle Paul was trying to dispel this circumcision, and say it is not a requirement under the new system, and calling him a liar because of that, and being slandered wherever he went, because the Judaizers followed him. You know that by studying his journeys, every one of them. He's saying, because of that, and they're affirming that this is what I say, they were misinterpreting what Paul is saying. What he's saying they're misinterpreting is this very statement. Let us do evil, that good may come. But that's not what Paul is saying. He's trying to point out that there's no group that is in a better position than any other group. Each group stands unjustified in the sight of God. So, the law can't help you. The natural law can't help you. There has to be something else to help you. Else, when God says that he so loves, that he does not wish that any should perish, but all come to repentance, would be worthless. If there wasn't some other way, because as Paul has pointed out, it's a grim situation that human beings stand in. Under the law, death is all you can hope for if you commit sin. You have to abide by the law perfectly in order to really gain life out of that. The Gentiles are not justified. They don't have life. So how do you get in a position where God can make that statement that he doesn't want any to, he wants everyone to repent. He doesn't want any to perish, because what is set up here, everyone would perish because there's no perfect salvation. So the outcome is that of that is God then had to provide. We can't provide, but God had to provide that sacrifice, which he did. But basically, the Judaizers, in effect, they're not saying it in so many words, but in effect, that's what they're saying. Everything that Christ did is null and void if you believe that any part of the law has to be carried over in the new system. Because that's not what it was given for. It just nullifies everything. Because what it does is it takes away from the power of God. All of this led up to showing man, to have a light bulb come on, I can't save myself. There's nothing I can do. So who am I dependent on? I'm dependent on God. And when you come to that realization, then you start looking, then what do I have to do in order for justification to happen so I can stand in a good grace with God? Obviously, God had to do something because he doesn't want me to perish. Any thoughts or comments? Okay, going forward, he's now going to conclude his whole argument temporarily, and he's going to start a whole new group of arguments, but right now he's going to conclude the logic with this, verse 9. What then? Are we better than they? Not at all. For we have previously charged, the Apostle Paul has, charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. One is not any better than the other. All mankind have sinned. The wages of sin is death. If you want to live, then there has to be something else. The Jewish system, same conclusion. The other system, the same conclusion. So there has to be something new. He goes on to say in verse 10, for it is written, and these statements are taken from the book of Psalms. The first one is going to be from Psalms 5. The next one's going to be from Psalms 10. And the next one from Psalms 36. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. Okay, that follows the argument Paul is saying. And remember, this comes prophesied, this comes out of the old law, out of the period of the old law. There is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who understands. There is none who seeks after God. Do you think this statement, while certainly having been true back there, is it true right here in the situation Paul is talking to? Notice the key statement is, not only has he proven neither side is righteous, there is none who understands. That's key. Is that a true statement of the congregation at Rome? For the most part, yes. What did they fail to understand? The Gentile failed to understand his requirements under the new system, else he could not be swayed that circumcision was necessary for him at all. So he didn't understand. And the Jews certainly didn't understand, thinking that they could impose any part of the old legal system under the new system. What is said in the New Testament? Christ, in Hebrews, the death of the testator nailed the old system on the cross with him. It was done away with, completely done away with. And you can argue about the similarities of the old law to the new law all you want. Principles of thought may have been carried over, but not a stipulation of the old system is part of the new system. It was all done away with. It's a whole new system. Just because some of the requirements of the old system just happen to be requirements of the new system, it's only logical and it's only the right thing to do, and we're able to understand that if we look at it. But there's a whole new system. Neither side right now understands not only the position they're in, but what they need to do really to get out of it. There is none who seek after God. So if you're in a position of sin and you've fallen short, you're isolated from God. So the Judaizers certainly aren't seeking after God if they're trying to impose the old ways into the new system. And you can argue that perhaps the Gentiles who were being swayed by that are not seeking after God, because if they abide by that teaching, it'll alienate them from God because it takes away from God's power. All right, he goes on in verse 12. They have all gone out of the way. They have together become unprofitable. That's both groups. Unprofitable to who? To God. There is none who does good. No, not one. Their throat is an open tomb. With their tongues, they have practiced deceit. The Judaizers have practiced deceit. If they even had an inkling of knowing what was right about what Paul said, that's not what they're stipulating. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. The Judaizers would have liked nothing better than, and were ultimately instrumental in having Paul incarcerated. because of his teaching. He was viewed as a heretic. And as a heretic, what was the punishment? Death. Ultimately, that was going to be his punishment, not at their hands, but at others' hands. Verse 16, destruction and misery are in their ways, and the way of peace they have not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. And if you look in the Jewish history, that was the case. They rejected the law. How many times have we read in our studies on Wednesday night that when a messenger from God came to them, they stiffened their neck, they hardened their heart. God says, I reach out and you turn your back on me. You accuse me, your creator, of not caring the situation. You're, where is God? He doesn't care what's going on. And he says, that's not the case. I reach out to you and you don't take hold. You ignore me. You refuse to do what I expect. That's what they did in their history. But Paul is showing that you're still doing that. There's a new system. And you're refusing, Judaizer, to understand that your old system is gone away and you don't have to apply it anymore. You're no better than they are, the ones you're trying to apply it to. Verse 19. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. In other words, what's the purpose of the law in the first place? To bring a knowledge of what sin is. If you know what sin is and understand that all men are guilty of it, where does that leave you? In an unjustified state relative to God. And nothing you can do yourself can change that. You don't have the power to do that. Isaiah says, no man and nothing on this earth, no precious gem, nothing is capable of being acceptable in the sight of God as a recompense for sin. There was only one perfect lamb, and that was the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ. Verse 20, therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight. Whose sight? God's sight. For by the law is the knowledge of sin. The point I had just made. That's what the Apostle Paul has been stating all along. This group is no better than that group. And the purpose of this system was to identify to mankind what sin is in the first place. And if you know what sin is and understand what your relationship to it is, with it is to God, then that's knowledge. If then you can take that knowledge and do something with it. In other words, what he's been saying, there's a new system. And you need to embed yourself in that new system if you hope to find the justification that you're after. And he's leading up to a final point. And we don't have the time to get into that. The next section, verse 21 through the end of the chapter, now deals with what is righteousness. He had pointed out in the previous chapter that certain events in the Old Testament for certain patriarchs had been counted to them for righteousness. And you can read in Hebrews 11, many call it the roll call of faith, because it starts with a description of faith and then starts showing an example of an individual who, through faith, it was counted to him by righteousness. And then in verse 6, we all know Hebrews 11:6. So then faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God is an explanation after the events that happened to Enoch. So, and he goes through everything, every verse starts, by faith, this individual. By faith, this individual. And it was all, everything they did, because of where their heart was, with respect to God, in obedience to him, was counted in their charge to righteousness. Now, what is righteousness? He's going to give a definition and explain what that is. And oh, by the way, chapter 4, guess who he's going to use to talk about as the shining example? Abraham. Because in chapter 11, whoever the writer was of Hebrews used Abraham above all the other examples that he has there. And so the Apostle Paul is going to use the argument here. Hebrews, the writer is not identified. anywhere, and no tradition clearly states who that writer was. Because of these arguments, and because of some other things that are stated in Hebrews, the style is very similar to Paul. And I choose to believe that it's Paul. You can believe whatever you want to. You can look at letters in the first century written by an elder in Rome. His name is Clement. He knew Paul. He was a disciple of Paul. And you can see Paul's style in his writing. So you can see, if you're a scholar who's not religious, and you find these fragments, and you find that letter, and by the way, that letter I'm referring to is the oldest surviving letter that's non-inspired in existence that we have, and you compare them to other manuscripts, you could see some confusion. Well, this looks like Paul. Here Paul clearly says it's him. He doesn't say who it is here. We don't know, and the dating of that book is such, it may or may not have been written by Paul, because it's questionable as to whether or not the date is after Paul's execution or before Paul's execution. But the point is whoever that writer was used Abraham as the shining example of faith, and Paul is going to use it here in chapter 4. So when you read chapter 4, go read Hebrews chapter 11 also. It's very important. Any thoughts or comments before we close? Okay. Lalo, can I get you to lead a closing prayer?
Father, divine Father, we thank you so much for this morning, for the opportunity to begin with you, Father, in this fashion by studying your word, and then now by worshiping you, Father. And help us always to remember your goodness, your beauty, your majesty, your glory, Father. Help us always to be thankful for everything that you have, for our families, for our church, Father, for our brothers. Thank you, Father, that we have faith and truly with us this morning in our service. That you still have to help us to open our hearts, Father. Thank you for who we are and for the past. And give us a blessing, Father.
Amen.